Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Niklas Nikolaisen. Niklas is a pioneer in the crypto financial sector in Switzerland and the founder of Bitcoin Swiss, one of the first Swiss companies providing crypto brokerage, ICO facilitation and advisory, and other related services. And today he is the chairman of the board and co-CEO. Niklas holds a degree in computer science from the Copenhagen Business School, and he has a background of more than 15 years as a professional software architect and developer, primarily in the financial, manufacturing, and public sectors. And now, to the interview. Hi, Niklas, and many thanks for making time today.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Niklas, we made an interview in 2016 about fintech in Switzerland, so I already know a little bit about you. But one thing I didn't know was a thing I recently read in an article, which was that you grew up in Africa and the Faroe Islands, which led you to question authority early on. So was there a specific experience that led you to this?
Well, grew up in Africa and the Faroe Islands might be a little bit stretching the truth. I spent a number of years of my childhood in Africa and on the Faroe Islands, but the majority of my childhood I did spend in Denmark. But it certainly has had a profound impact on me, not maybe so much the part with the Faroe Islands in regards to authorities. But I did see a lot of failed states and failed governments visiting Africa, not only in my childhood, but also when I went back in my youth to visit my father who worked there. And it's important when we are sitting in very well-working jurisdictions here in Western Europe, I think, and maybe specifically in Switzerland, to remember that this is not always the case, not only all over the world, but also in time. It was not that long ago that even in Europe we had horrible governments and jurisdictions, and we still do in most of the world. And this is something we should sometimes think in when we make solutions and when we make regulation and when we make and grant and give powers to the state.
When was that? When did you live there? I mean, were you really small or were you already going to university there?
My father worked in Africa since the late 60s on different relief projects, European-funded relief projects. Later on, moving from that sector into diplomacy. And he brought the family down to Ethiopia, where we lived for about 2 years when I was about 6 or 7 years old. But since then, I have gone back to Africa maybe as much as 10 times, visiting my father on extended journeys. The last time I spent a significant amount of time in Africa was in Liberia when I was around 18 years old, where I spent a little more than 2 months. And Liberia at the time was ravaged by a civil war that later spilled over into the Ivory Coast and also destroyed Sierra Leone. And it was often when I visited Africa, because my father worked with the relief projects, you were in the eye of the storm of disasters. And most of these disasters were not really natural disasters. They were indeed human created. And then you get a little bit of a different perspective on the world. You can see how quickly things can go from very well working, like in the case of the Ivory Coast, that was a beautiful country, to completely destroyed through war, through government, through dictatorships and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And what led you then to become a software architect?
Originally, I wanted to to study chemistry. That was the passion of my childhood. And I also started at the university studying chemistry. But rather fast, I found out there was a difference between the chemistry of my imagination and the chemistry of reality, in that I didn't want to end up spending the rest of my life testing the acidity of shampoo on some laboratory. I wanted something more, something where you really were making things. And it was in the early 90s, right before the internet, or in the start of the internet revolution, when internet went mainstream, and all the universities were adding software engineering and IT to their curriculums. And I thought, this is probably what I really want to work with, because you can get an amazing result in a rather short amount of time when you develop software. It's like being a craftsman. And it appealed to me, and it also did not appeal to very many other people, which meant that that the salaries were high, mm-hmm. and that maybe also drew a little bit in that direction. So I switched, and I became a software engineer.
Mm-hmm. And you also joined the cypherpunk movement. I mean, was that during your time as a student or afterwards?
Now, the cypherpunk movement weren't something you joined. There were no membership cards. There were no list of who was who and so forth. Actually, people started to meet up in internet forums and discuss how the world could be changed through IT technology. How many of the things that where we relied on humans who are fallible could perhaps in the future be decided by impartial and infallible software. The movement, quote-unquote movement, wasn't even a movement. It was message boards and forums that were more or less publicly accessible to everybody, so it wasn't secretive at all. Yeah, sure, there were also a lot of private messages floating around, and it attracted my attention, and I should note that I was not a key contributor to the debate, but I was certainly following it. It attracted my attention because many of the beliefs there were the same beliefs that I had. A high focus on individual liberty, somewhat of a mistrust for human-built systems, and then, of course, technology itself, IT technology and encryption and so forth on the very highest levels. And it was on those message boards that or forums that Satoshi's white paper about Bitcoin was first floated. And I was not even fast to discover that in a cypherpunk context, but I certainly did discover it before a lot of other people did. And I, of course, fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm. In 2010, that was?
That was in 2010, yes. One of my friends was also very much following the cypherpunk debates, even closer than I did. He was, however, not a software engineer as such. But he sent me a link to where the white paper was first published. And then he really wanted my feedback on the document. And I was at the time very busy, so I was saying, yeah, I will read it, I will read it. And he kept bringing it up. And eventually then I did read it because, okay, I promised him to read it and provide some feedback. And what was even more clear to me than it had been to him was that you are dealing with something absolutely revolutionizing, the blockchain and the Bitcoin concepts. It was not even new technology, well, some of it was. It was the beautiful combination of existing technologies and then just moving it that single step forward that made everything make perfect sense. And the white paper completely checked out, and I just knew that that this was going to be something that would have a major impact on the world.
Mm-hmm. Is there a specific thing? I mean, you mentioned before that combination was beautiful, where many different things that existed previously were put together in this white paper in a very ingenious way. But was there an application or a potential that immediately was apparent to you when you read that?
The application that that the white paper itself promoted was the cash aspect and a digital peer-to-peer electronic cash system, I think the white paper said. What I saw was what the white paper laid out, that here you could for the first time probably have a money system which was decentralized, which solved the Byzantine generals problem, which solved the consensus problem, which solved settlement problems, which would be electronic and transferable all over the world at low cost and so forth and so forth. I did not immediately see all the thousands and thousands of other application blockchain technology and decentralized consensus technology would bring and have been bringing. For that, you needed, I think, really next-level visionaries such as Vitalik Buterin and so forth to say, but wait a moment, we can also make smart contracts, and smart contracts can make almost anything. I was quick to catch on to that as well, but once again, it took other visionaries than myself. But I did see the monetary aspect of Bitcoin. I was at the time myself a gold buck, which is a gold lover. Not that I had stacked my house full of gold, but gold was a non-promise, non-government-based monetary system where you could rely on predictable inflation and so forth. And I thought, looking at how different monetary systems were used all over the world to plunder populations and also to enforce central control, that it would be much better returning to something like the gold standard. But you cannot electronically transfer gold. You can only electronically transfer the promises of gold. So you needed something different. And that was what I saw Bitcoin immediately solved, having a monetary system that would work exactly the same for you as for a top-level official in a bank or in government, a democratic money, a money that was only a protocol and that treated everybody equally and that you could really trust because it didn't rely on any single party or on suspicious meetings in central banks and so forth. And then, as you said, there are so many other applications that that quickly became clear to me. I think I started to catching on to that in around 2013, very much driven by the process that later became the Ethereum Foundation.
But between that was also a stint, I think, at a consulting company and then Credit Suisse in Switzerland.
Yes, I worked. I wanted to work with Bitcoin from the moment I discovered it. My first initial instinct was to go to the management of the IT consulting company where I worked and just give them the white paper and say, listen, read this. This is like the second coming of the internet. And then I thought that they would read it and then that they would somehow have almost a crisis meeting about how could the company position itself to develop a solution based on Bitcoin and so forth. But I quickly realized that the white paper had impacted me in a much higher degree than it did on most others who read it.
Did they even read it?
Yeah, sure. They looked at it and they also heard my summary and said, oh, this could be maybe interesting in the future. Now let's get back to the IT solutions that we are actually developing. And I was a little disappointed that they didn't think that we should immediately, you know, switch into the Bitcoin business. But of course, retrospectively, that made perfect sense from their standpoint. But I did decide that I wanted to work with it. And there were literally no companies at that time. There was the major Bitcoin scene at that time had... was in San Francisco, and a year later the focus moved to New York, where it stayed for 2 years until heavy regulation more or less destroyed the scene. There were no companies, so I decided to make a company myself, and I thought Denmark would probably be uphill place to start such a company, so I start looking around for another jurisdiction.
Why would that be?
Financial Market Supervision Authority in Denmark is traditionally not known to be keen on fintech companies. There are no major fintechs that ever came out of Denmark, I think, for the same reason. Sweden, sure, but not Denmark. Secondly, company taxes were very high. Personal taxes are also very high, which means that should you, against all odds, succeed as an entrepreneur, then you have a very small upside, because we all agree, as an entrepreneur, you will most likely fail. And at the same time, and Denmark also has no great reputation as a financial marketplace, so I thought you needed to get closer to the action. I thought about the City of London, I thought about Singapore, but I also thought about Switzerland. And at the end of the day, the small jurisdiction size of Switzerland and the tradition for decentralization and the great reputation as a financial marketplace and the access to highly skilled labor and so forth all came together to favor Switzerland in my decision process. And that's why I resigned from my job in Denmark and moved to Switzerland. And there it is correct that the first few years I worked again in a consulting company, which placed me in Credit Suisse.
And then you again hoped that they would understand what the white paper meant for their business.
I was almost religious in the first few years after discovering Bitcoin, to the point where I was annoying not only at family dinners, but certainly also in the lunch breaks at the different jobs I had, because I had to talk about Bitcoin.
What did you say usually when you talked about it?
Depended, of course, very much if I was talking to somebody who never heard it before, or if they were already following my my track from the previous lunch presentations. But I tried to make people understand that these blockchain solutions, first of all Bitcoin, but also later on the whole aspect of tokenization and consensus, was going to change the world, and that it was probably a very good idea to buy a few hundred Bitcoins, which at the time, when I got into the space, had a price of zero. Bitcoin didn't cost anything. And later on, you know, cents on the dollar. So I wasn't asking people to throw their pension savings. I said, just, you know, buy Bitcoin for $200. You won't regret it. It should be considered inside of Credit Suisse that we took this topic seriously. And that's also the name Bitcoin Suisse, the company where I'm the chairman today, and which I founded in 2013 with some partners, I named Bitcoin Suisse because I originally had it as a pitch towards Credit Suisse, that they consider Bitcoin and later crypto assets in general inside of their thinking, mainly on the asset management or wealth management side of things. But that did not succeed to take off within Credit Suisse. Actually, I was asked to not destroy every lunch break talking about this internet anarchist hocus pocus currency. So in the end, I had to go and do it myself.
But what were the counter arguments? I mean, one more question about Credit Suisse, and then we move on. What were the arguments that they had against it? Did they say this is just, you know, an idea and it's going to fail, or how did they react?
I think that the sentiment was very much the same as at my previous place of employment. We have a running business. You are employed to support that business. You are not here to try to revolutionize our business. That was the overall argument. And on more on the Bitcoin level, it was clearly that Bitcoin can never work with banking and banking regulation. And I retrospectively can absolutely see that that was a key point. Big banks who have interests not only in Switzerland but all over the world, for them, crypto assets has for the past few years been one big gray zone. And why would you, as a multi-billion dollar global corporation, even take the risk of considering to look at these things and the costs of understanding these things when you have a fine business already? You invite a lot of uncertainty, and that's not what the banks want. I mean, you have almost, when something big happens in the business where you are, you have to almost be forced to take it seriously, because nobody wants, if you have a stable business, to deal with something completely new. Now, of course, the situation is very much different. All the banks are looking into blockchain technology and so forth. And now it also makes sense. I mean, the whole market is thousands times greater than it was back in the day when I was going around as a Bitcoin Jesus. I think my timing was simply wrong. I think if I had come some years later, then maybe this would have made sense and people would have listened more.
In 2015, you mean?
Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe even 2016. When it eventually became clear to me that I should start my own company, and this was very much helped by the financial gains that not only I had, but also all of the people I convinced to invest in crypto assets had, the timing was perhaps also not the best, because for the first year, or maybe even 1.5 years, we were struggling. We got started in 2013 and things were actually looking very good, but then came all of the major crypto disasters, maybe most notably the collapse of Mt. Gox, which at the time was the biggest crypto exchange. And then we saw a whole year of declining Bitcoin prices. And you know, the first few months, you're saying, yeah, but this is only natural and the prices grew too fast and now we are seeing a correction. But after 6 months, then it looks more and more questionable. And after 9 months, you have the parents of your employees calling, saying, please, please release my sons because they have a life to live and you're destroying their career. And that was tough, right? But then eventually, of course, it did turn around.
The company is a Bitcoin brokerage, right?
You mean today?
Yes, I mean, but when you started, you
started. Oh, yes. When we started, we were very much what you would call a side street broker, which is the not so nice term for a typically small, unregulated financial institution dealing in something that other people don't want to deal in and where many people come in from the street, aka side street broker. So people would for a long time physically appear at our office and they would have 500 francs and wanted to change it into Bitcoin and talk about Bitcoin later on, also Ethereum and so forth. And that was a whole other business than we are today. But there were very little regulation on the area. We were one of the first to become AML regulated and to become a financial intermediary in 2014. Now, the regulation topic is a whole other one. We are looking into fintech license, banking license. We are looking into a securities dealer's license in Switzerland and abroad. But it was very much a local exchange service. And for several months, 3 or 4 months, the company as such didn't even have a bank account because nobody wanted to deal with this Bitcoin topic. I mean, if you put Bitcoin at the time into Google, you would see something like Silk Road and Mt. Gox and people lose $500 million and a lot of negative things. And we were not hiding what we were doing. I mean, we put Bitcoin into the company name. It's Bitcoin Swiss. So we had no banks. I mean, people were physically mailing us, you know, money for the exchange services. And we were emptying a postbox, you know, every morning. And there would be letters from people. And that was actually how a lot of our transactions went on. Finally, we landed a banking relationship. So we had to go abroad into a small private bank. I remember that meeting very vividly. They knew we were pretty desperate. It was the 53rd bank interview I went to in order to establish a banking relationship.
Wow.
And they were looking at me, oh, since you come here, you're probably what, in the weapons industry, or are you dealing in like in Iran or something like that, since you come to our place, because they are, of course, one of the more flexible banks. Mm-hmm. And then I said, no, actually, we're dealing in Bitcoin and crypto assets. And then he looked scared. I mean, the intonation of weapon, he was cool with that, but Bitcoin, then he was scared. But we did convince them.
Mm-hmm.
And from there on, over a long, slow process, did we establish more and more banking relationships as our track record grew. And today, of course, it's we have some pretty strong relationships. But by God, it wasn't easy at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw that you, in an article about you, you said it was an amazing harassment from the banks, maybe mostly in Switzerland. But how do you, what is your experience there today?
I'm incredibly sorry. I saw it, I think it was FinNews who wrote that. I gave a very long interview on our history with banking. And it is correct that I at some point mentioned that, in connection with specifically one bank. But it came out as I had been sitting and complaining. I had also in that interview told that I retrospectively completely understand the situation that the banks are in. You have a new topic. Now our regulation coming in place. I mean, this was a toxic topic for large banks to deal with. And at the same time, you have this new industry. And with a new industry, you don't see the professionals moving in first. No. You see the enthusiasts moving in first. I myself didn't come from a financial side. And when some young guys appear in a bank saying, there's this new internet money and it's really cool and we have no idea of finances, accounting and blah, blah, blah. And people will be, of course, a bank will say, hey, wait a minute, you can do whatever you want, but not in our bank. So their stance make quite a lot of sense. And we have had some banks in Switzerland that had a tradition of blocking our transactions and actually making our money disappear. Not banks that we used, but that served as intermediary banks. So when you move money from one bank to another, they will call neighbor banks, who will call neighbor banks, who will call the receiving banks. That's how the banking system works. And some of these banks would simply, when they saw the name Bitcoin Swiss, they would have a list of keywords, you know, terror, Al-Qaeda, Bitcoin, all of these words were on the list. And then the transaction would be seized and simply disappear and it wouldn't arrive. And that's when I made the comments that some of these harassments were pretty amazing, especially from one major bank. But certainly the banks that we've been working with and also the Swiss banking relationships and foreign banking relationships we have today have been very good banking relationships. When FinNews wrote only these negative things and excluded all of the positive things that I have said, I had phone calls with our banking partner saying, you make us look like idiots. Why did you say that? And I said, as I say now, I was quoted out of context.
Well, things have changed. That's good. And I'm glad you explained. I mean, that makes a lot of sense because often still today, I think often people in this space, they paint a picture where a lot of banks and a lot of people are very much against them. More maybe for ideological reasons, they always, it always looks like that. But it's maybe not like this in every case.
Well, a bank is a business, and a business has the right to choose who they provide services. And the crypto scene, as I said, it was new, it was small, the risk of engaging was probably higher than the potential gain for some banks. Some banks, of course, chose this as a special thing that they would profile themselves on, but others would say, doesn't make sense. And the actors that came into the space, and many of which are still in the space, were not the professionals. Many of them don't know about simple topics such as regulation and compliance. and finance and accounting and so forth. They are really, you know, gung-ho entrepreneurs. And this is all fine when you are making new plastic gadgets. But when you are dealing with finance and your banking relationship and banking partners actually are liable for providing the infrastructure for your business and can have a lot of problems if you do not know what you're doing, then I can understand some hesitation from the banks. Now, things are, of course, becoming much better. I mean, for Bitcoin Swiss, banking is no longer an issue. I mean, we have a long track record. We are regulated. We are working closely with the FINMA. We have a staff that know what they are doing. We have proper accounting procedures, proper procedures in all of these aspects that you're supposed to have. But for free, young guys coming in saying, "Ah, we want to do this revolutionary thing and we are going to like raise $100 million. It's an ICO from people we don't know who are." And I can completely understand a bank that wasn't very cautious on this would suffer major damage. However, there are a number of smaller banks who have made this one of their focuses and have taking the time to understand the technology and the challenges from a banking perspective and who are now making tremendously good business in this sector. And I think it will only be a matter of time before crypto assets are part of every bank's business.
Mm-hmm. A matter of time, a few years or?
A few years.
Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today.
A few years, not more. You will see slowly all kind of assets moving onto the blockchain. Not only the traditional cryptocurrencies or payment tokens such as Bitcoin, but also stocks and bonds and real estate and gold and just about anything can be tokenized. And once it's tokenized, it can be listed on markets all over the world and traded, and it can even be held by the clients themselves. They don't have to rely on a depot that is another bank or broker holding their assets for them. You can't have another Lehman Brothers collapse with billions and billions of dollars simply being lost in the crypto world. And you can list your company without being a multi-hundred-million-dollar company, which is what's required to do an IPO, right? Because you can just tokenize and list yourself anywhere, even on a small local exchange if you want it. And these exchanges themselves are not even companies anymore, but they are just programs living on the blockchain. So it will undoubtedly, and you can quote me on that, be a part of any major banks and exchanges business in the future.
When?
In a short matter of a few years.
Mm-hmm. 2020, 21?
Let's say 21. Then I'm definitely pretty safe.
It's hard to make these predictions, and I pushed you a little bit there.
It's hard to make predictions, especially about the future.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the future, you mentioned before decentralization, having blockchains that store tokenized real assets in a decentral way. What is your view on decentralized exchanges?
I think that having decentralized markets and exchanges is a little bit of a challenge in a regulatory sense, because the exchanges used to be where you could really apply regulation. However, with the nature of blockchain technology, this is something that will just come, or already actually is there. And for those who don't know it, traditionally you would have centralized exchanges. Just 20 years ago, you were dealing with a big room like the commodities exchanges with 1,000 brokers running around and traders in pits and shouting and so forth. Later, the last 20 years, that's all been digitalized into central exchanges in Switzerland, SIX, and in the US, the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ and Chicago Commodities and so forth. And this was where you could really apply regulation. But with blockchain technology, you can set up programs, computer programs, and deploy them not on a server in a basement of a company, but deploy them directly on the blockchain that run exchange services autonomously without human interference. It will just work. You can go there and you can list your tokens, whatever they may be, or you can trade against other tokens. Now, these decentralized exchanges, they don't work with traditional money. They work with crypto assets only. But everything is becoming tokenized. Today, there's tokenized dollars, there's tokenized euros, there's even tokenized crypto assets. So Bitcoin, for example, does not lend itself well to be tokenized, like the Ethereum protocol. But then there are people who then tokenize Bitcoin on the Ethereum protocol and on the next generation blockchains that are coming. But the interesting thing is, what will you then do regulation-wise? I do not really foresee that you can stop this development, because nobody asks you for permission when you deploy a smart contract to the to a blockchain. Maybe some jurisdictions will try to make decentralized exchanges illegal, but it's basically the same as making gravity illegal. I mean, you can do it, but it has no real effect. So we are going to have to find out how we are going to operate in a world where it's not actually the exchange of the assets themselves that are directly regulated. Or perhaps some blockchains in the future will support and maybe even require identity objects of some kind. That can also not be ruled out. We'll just have to see what the future brings. I, however, are very much positive about the decentralized exchange technology itself, because it allows the barrier of trading places to become much smaller. Today, when you go on the SIX stock exchange, you won't find, you know, the local sugar company listed there. You won't find your local tobacco shop or kiosk listed there. You will only find the big companies. Smaller companies, it's all what you call private equity. So if you want to trade your shares there, you have to go and find a buyer. Maybe you even list it in a newspaper somewhere. I want to sell some shares, or I want to buy some shares. There's no price discovery. It's difficult for buyers and sellers to find them other, and that means that small companies don't have access to capital in the same way that larger companies do. If all the local shops were listed on small decentralized exchanges, maybe specializing in Souk, or maybe specializing in Western Switzerland, or specializing in different areas of business, then this would mean that there would be a lot of more investment into companies going on, even small investments. So mom and pop shops can raise, 6,000 francs for a new shelf in the back room and expand them. And this will mean growth. This will mean more jobs. This will mean more wealth. Right now, also in the venture capitalist and private equity scene, the big winners there are the sharks. The specialists who will go in and say, yeah, you can have some money and your idea is really great, but I give you 8 francs and I want 50% of the company. And while this is very good for the specialists in the business, this might not be the best way for the people who want to create the businesses. And that means, at the end of the day, is that fewer businesses are created. Because if you have who, you have to give away all of your company and control for just a small amount of money, then it's maybe better that you keep your normal job. But when capital becomes easily available, the whole world becomes a Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is very famous as an incubation space for good ideas, because you can go there and you can meet the investors and you can get help finding an office and you can, you know, everything is there. But if you could expand Silicon Valley to cover the whole world, and I'm not just talking the Western world, but also the developing world, now then the whole world becomes a Silicon Valley, and 1, 2, 3, we will all be flying in jet cars and having colonies on Mars. That's why I'm very positive about this technology.
Mm-hmm. Would definitely be nice if it happened like this. Still, you're here in Zug, and you're very active in this whole movement of Crypto Valley, right? Zug as a place for innovation in blockchain technology and crypto. How important is location for you?
Unlike many of the other companies in the space, or indeed many fintech startups in general, now we are not a startup anymore, but we are not like many of these other companies, what you would call a networking business, which is we got three guys in England and two guys in, and blah, blah, blah. The company is spread all over the world. You meet on the internet and so forth. We are really a brick and mortar company. We have two large offices, one for technologies and development in Denmark and one for our financial services in Switzerland. And when you are a physical company with offices and where everybody is working together, then, of course, location for that company is pretty important. And I think Zug, and maybe also indeed much of Switzerland, is a very good place to have a company. It has the right combination of attractive traits, as I mentioned before, competitive taxes, friendly regulation, access to the European marketplace, access to highly skilled labor, and so forth. I'm not saying that you can't have a networking company with success where people are spread all over the world. But even so, you would also need legal entities. And these legal entities you can, with some benefit, place in friendly jurisdictions. Now, there are what I would call super friendly jurisdictions. That is those suspicious small islands and other things where they're basically saying, just come here, we don't care what you're doing, just give us some money at the door and you can go wild. That's not where we want to be in finance, because they also provide no legal certainties for your clients. Mm-hmm. If you make a terrible scam out of such a small jurisdiction, well, then they are not going to pursue you. They simply don't have the means to pursue you. I have never heard of the Seychelles authorities successfully bringing, people to court in terms of scams. So people want a jurisdiction that they can rely on, and Switzerland does have that, and at the same time has many of the business friendly traits. So it's the right combination. Zug in itself, the crypto value concept is really not just Zug. It's basically stretches not only across Switzerland, but even to some extent across the world. But Zug is one of the leading jurisdictions. Zurich is also attracting a lot of these businesses, and Liechtenstein recently came on board. And I think these areas put and take crypto financial business seriously in terms of regulation, in terms of taxes and so forth. Whereas in some of the traditional bigger jurisdictions, New York, London, so forth, it's just too small that anybody cares. And that is why I think the business is establishing here. You're dealing with some pretty good jurisdictions without being too flexible, as I'm not going to mention any names, but as some of the more suspect jurisdictions. And they are putting it front and center. They are investing in it. You're seeing even government and public sector and also the universities engaging in this space. And that is why it is amongst the leading crypto jurisdictions. And I think it will continue to grow. And I'm very happy for the small part that we have played in that. We were the first professional company working with the crypto asset topic in Switzerland. since then, certainly a lot of other people have come and contributed to the sector, and there's too many to mention. Today we have also an association, a crypto value association, where many of these companies sit together and which promotes the space and which works with government and universities and so forth. And I think this is a sector that will continue to grow and already today is providing quite a lot of good jobs in Zug, Zurich and Liechtenstein, and certainly in the future will provide a lot more.
And also is spearheading maybe models for other jurisdictions to follow, how to deal with regulation, how to deal with, you know, job creation and all those kind of things.
I think the FINMA is certainly one of the leading regulatory bodies and leading competences inside of regulatory bodies on the topic of crypto assets or blockchain in general. And this is, for me, a great thing that we, the jurisdiction we are sitting in, is a trend-setting jurisdiction, because that means that we actually get a chance to be heard and affect the legislation that is being made instead of just having it imposed on us.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, you mentioned before, you mentioned FINMA, you mentioned banks have become more friendly with you or with the crypto sector in general in Switzerland. Some people I speak with, they interpret this as signs maybe that, you know, the crypto space starts emulating some of the signs that, you know, centralized authorities previously also had, you know, for example, to start consolidating, to start becoming some kind of club that becomes more and more exclusive. Do you see a risk of that happening?
Well, it's true that that the players in the crypto sector are consolidating. It is also true that we are doing our best to cooperate with the banking sector, traditional banking sector, and to comply and cooperate with regulators. I am not sure that this should be viewed necessarily as a big sellout or a big centralization. The crypto technology brings a lot of efficiency with it. And I think it is beautiful to see the thriving environment that the, let's say, the period of non-regulation inspired. But at the end of the day, it was also had a shadow side. I mean, what happened with the Bitcoin that disappeared at Mt. Gox? What happened with many other similar disasters? What happened with a lot of investor money that went into scams like OneCoin or and similar big we just recently had another Ponzi scheme that came crashing down, and this of course the shadow side of the completely unregulated environment. At the end of the day, we have to take the good things of the systems that we had and combine with the good things that the crypto quote-unquote revolution and the blockchain can bring. And I think that's being done. And it's very similar to when you saw the colonization of America. For hundreds of years, America was actually only the coasts and the whole middle, the Wild West, were uninhabited. And when people started moving out there, you saw the pioneers. You didn't see, you know, the established people. They were living in their mansions on the East Coast. But you saw the pioneers. They went out and they built these boom towns. And they there was, you know, shootouts in the saloons and the streets. And as things matured, order came. And it's the same thing here. We are very much moving out of the Wild West phase and into the established phase, and that will, of course, mean that we have to comply with real world regulation and so forth. And I think that's how it is. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's correct. It's perhaps more difficult to start a crypto asset brokerage today than it was when I did it. But I don't make the rules, but I certainly have to follow them.
Recently, I read in an article that you said, if we don't screw it up, blockchain technology will triumph in the coming years. So now we spoke about a few things that could go wrong, you know, with that Wild West analogy that you just made. But how else could we screw this up?
Now we are back at it's hard to predict, especially about the future. We are in a very dynamic environment where we are really seeing, as I told you before, assets of just about any kind moving up onto the blockchain. You're seeing a tremendous amount of fundraising moving from traditional venture capitalism and private equity and even IPOs into the ICO space, where you release tokens for fundraising and so forth. And there is a tremendous amount of pitfalls from our side, from the side of the market actors. We can screw it up by allowing criminal money into and criminal enterprises to thrive in our system. That is, if we do not self-censor ourselves and try to work against the many gold diggers and scammers and Ponzi schemes that are still existing inside the crypto sector, if we blindly allow, let's say, the North Korean dictatorship to move $10 billion into the crypto scene, I don't know, invest in ICOs and whitewash their money and use them to build nuclear missiles and so forth. That's from our side. That's one of the many things that we can do wrong. And then, of course, we can not take the responsibilities that we have against the clients seriously. That would mean, here at Bitcoin Suisse, for example, that the private keys of the clients were floating all on the tables and their passport copies were hanging on the wall and all of these things. If we want to be taken seriously, we better be able to provide banking-grade services instead of the services that we saw in the past at, for example, the failing exchanges and Mt. Gox and so forth. From the side of regulators and governments, of course, these things can, quote-unquote, be screwed up if they tighten the noose of regulation so hard that they strangle the child before it's even born. And their regulators should, and also governments should work together with the crypto market participants and participants, and probably also the traditional financial participants to make a framework that both allows for the growth and also takes into account the safety of the clients and the investors. But if you had applied from the very first day heavy banking regulation on top of the crypto financial scene, well, then nobody would have been able to comply. We were grassroots. We came up not as big banks, but as small groups of entrepreneurs. And if we had to, from day one, comply to the same level of banking regulation for our businesses, then we probably would never have started. And we saw that the banks certainly didn't start by themselves. But I think Switzerland is hitting the right amount of sandboxing. And then when business starts to grow and become large, then they apply the regulation. And that's what we have to aim for. Within the industry, we have to provide the proper services, and self-censoring and compliance. And within the government sector and the regulation sector, they have to allow this technology to grow and thrive, because it's going to bring huge benefits to the economy and to the world.
Mm-hmm. Cool. What if somebody came to you, you know, maybe somebody who's, you know, 18, 20 years old, and he said, or she said, I'm not happy with the way authorities run this world. And I like cryptocurrencies. I like the blockchain. I want to use this to make the world a better place. But I don't know where to start. What would you tell such a person?
I think that is exactly what technology will do in the years to come. Not just consensus technologies, but certainly also technologies such as AI are already changing the world. If you want to change the world for something better, but you don't know how to approach the topic, then you are like 99% of all human beings. We all want to see a better world. We are all not very sure about how to go about it. So I would say that if you do not have a vision, then look at all the visionaries and competing visions that are out there and find the one that you can identify with and seek out those people and go and work with them. I could not find any when I got involved in the space, and that's why I made my own approach. But certainly, if you do not know where you're going, you probably best try to study the topic a little bit closer and find somebody where you sympathize with what they're doing and where you love it, because we spend so much time at work that we might as well make it an enjoyable part of life, or we should strive to it, at least us in the Western world who have that opportunity. A lot of people don't. And changing the world is a very ambitious strategy. Even changing a country is a very ambitious goal. I usually say that that's something one should really try to accomplish only when one have at least addressed the motions of changing oneself into the person that one wants to be. If you can manage to change yourself into the person that you want to be, then you can work on the country level and on the world level. But aiming for the world straight away, changing it as an 18-year-old, that's maybe ambitious. There's much to learn, there's much to see, and I'm sure you will find out where you're going to end. I mean, I remember having these thoughts myself. What am I going to do? What is my role going to be in the world? Every young person has to find out and will find out eventually what makes them tick. And far too many people engage themselves with things that they don't really want to do. And thus they become often mediocre at doing it. So who am I to say how that individual should indeed change the world? I think I would need a little more information on it. But please go with your passion. I mean, it's a cliche. But if you go with your passion, I think you will never fail. And that's certainly, I somewhat myself stand to a testament to that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Personally, when you embarked on this path, or when you, you know, just came in touch with these ideas, how did you go about finding your own passion?
Well, certainly also through a lot of trial and error. I loved doing software development and architecture for many years. But at the same time, I wasn't really doing the kind of software that I was really hoping for. And I always had a keen interest in politics and finance. And it was a miracle for me that all of a sudden somebody bridged IT and money and finance and politics in the way that Satoshi did, and gave birth to the quote-unquote crypto revolution. Because I think the implications of consensus technology and AI will go far, far, far beyond money and even tokenization of assets. It will also, now we are talking the long vision, of course, have a profound impact on law, government, and societies. I think a lot of the things where we rely on human beings right now to make often decisions that were not optimal and not based on the consensus of neither the people or the consensus or let's say the full knowledge of everything, which only the market really can provide. All of these things are going to be changed slightly, slowly in the future and replaced with technology. I think we're still many years away from a supercomputer ruling the world. And the supercomputer would also always be a problem. But combined with consensus technology and distribution, then we are coming into having really a lot of job functions in government that we can now automize and make provable, infallible. And this will mean a lot to the world. That's a lot of people that will be freed up from stamping papers and from controlling people who stamp papers and from controlling the controllers into going out and providing products and services and wealth for the world.
That's the long vision, and I think it's a beautiful vision. Just sometimes I wonder, there are so many steps between. And if somebody is stamping paper or is controlling somebody who stamps paper, then that's all they know, maybe. And it sounds very, you know, very big to have that vision that you just outlined. So I wonder sometimes, what should somebody do with that vision that you know, somebody who's not part of crypto assets yet, who doesn't maybe know even what Bitcoin is, who has no idea what the blockchain could do. How should they, you know, maybe, you know, acquire new skills or go about playing also a role in that future that you just outlined?
Well, nothing happens from one day to another. And a changing world is a natural process. The world has always been changing. If you go back 200 years, 90% of the population in Switzerland were engaged in farming. Today, 90% of the population in Switzerland, or even more, is not engaged in farming. Now, how did all of those people in the farming sector all of a sudden move out and acquire the skills to become everything from lawyers to bus drivers to whatever they are doing now? This was a gradual process. And it's not only the only example I can make for that. The world changes all the time. It's only 20 years ago that every newspaper had a huge staff which set the lead types into, you know, the printing machines for every page to be printed in the newspaper. Today we have printing technology. It's only 30 years ago that you had all of the accounting jobs done virtually by hand and a hand calculator and paper, and today it's done by computers. And think about the profound changes that the internet brought. I mean, these, and it also moved a lot of people from doing A to doing B. But it's a gradual process, and I don't think you need to worry too much about it. Every company will always, when things change, change along with it, and along with that comes new position. And you have to ask yourself, there were one time when you knew very little of the world, but you went out and got a job and you got really good at it. And you can do that again and again and again. And I don't think anybody who is approaching retirement age needs to worry about this. They can only know with some certainty that blockchain and consensus technology and things like Bitcoin, tokenization and so forth will bring a richer world. And a richer world will mean that your retirement is more safe. You can get more stuff from the hard-earned savings that you did. And for everybody else, it's going to mean more companies, more job opportunities, higher pay, moving towards the time when you will maybe retire. So it's not something to be afraid of. The world will always change. Had it not been this, it would have been something else. And even after blockchain and consensus and decentralization, will there be in the future something again? Maybe, I don't know, magnetic drives will change the auto industry completely or who knows what. Humankind is successful not because we are specialized like other animals with shells on our back or big claws or night vision or anything. We are successful because we are so good at adapting and because we're generalized and have faith in that design, which has proven so successful also to move the next step.
Mm-hmm. So it's a natural evolution. It comes anyway.
It comes anyway. And the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, the IT revolution that we just went through, at the end of the day, did not create mass poverty and mass unemployment. No, it created wealth. We're way better off now after the internet and the IT revolution that we was before. The industrial revolution made us way better off than before when we were in the feudal societies. The agricultural revolution made us way better off than when we were running around chasing deers in the forest or being chased by cave bears. The average life expectancy are going up. Most people, even on welfare in the West today, live better than a king did in the Middle Ages. And now we will have yet another groundbreaking set of technologies that are going to make us all more wealthy and hopefully also happier. If not, then you are a real ungrateful person. And that's nothing to be afraid of. That's something to cherish.
Mm-hmm. Niklas, if you weren't working with Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology, what would you like to be doing?
I really have the job that I have a passion for at the moment. And then, of course, it's hard to say what would I be doing if I wouldn't be doing that. I thought about it a few times. I would maybe be a teacher because every time when I am in the role of a teacher, I actually enjoy myself and I feel that I am pretty good at explaining things and doing it in a non-boring way, much opposed to the way that many of the teachers I had were. I don't know if that's the end answer to that. I could maybe also be having, you know, a small specialized shop or even a bar where I would be going behind the desk like, with a happy smile on my face and talking to all the clients and talking about what's happening in the society and so forth. I could do a lot of things. The only thing I can guarantee that I'll never do was get into politics.
And maybe back into banking.
Well, now we are moving into crypto banking. But that is...
Into traditional banking, I meant.
No. I think that would be... I think, as I said, we are now merging with banking into becoming crypto banking, which will bring... additional transparency and lower costs for everybody. And I don't think in 10 years that there are going to be any difference between crypto finance and traditional finance. It's only going to be finance and a better one than we have today. Just like we today have much better cars than we had 10 years ago, we will have much better banking in 10 years than we have now.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for these insights and also for being so open about what you experienced and what you see in the future. Thanks so much for taking time today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guest and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.